We are glad that you are still here with us as we continue. This is the second week from the garden to the garden city, trying to look at the Bible in 6 weeks and how do we take in its message. We finished last week. We were talking about creation, the garden. We talked about the snake. And we finished last week with a tower where the people of God have basically gotten to a point where they're trying to reach up into the heavens, and they were so broken, they were so violent, they had so much evil in their heart that God thought, to be able to just keep these people alive, I have to disperse them around the world. I need to confuse their languages so they don't continue to get themselves into trouble. And that's the Tower of Babel story. And we look at it as a whole, and sometimes that happens. I mean, we take different people groups, we put them into different ghettos, and the different ghettos never cross over to each other. And there's cities in America that were like that even 30, 50 years ago. Some are kind of like that today. And it's all because we can't get along because of this brokenness that's in our heart. And we all take it back to the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And so today, the question is, what is God's remedy when life is broken and we're messed up? What was his remedy then, and then what does he want to do now? His remedy then was a covenant, which is a word for a promise, a new relationship between two. And it's a covenant that he made with an old man and an old woman. And so Abraham and Sarah, and this is important because Abraham's name at first was Abram, a shorter form of Abraham. And this name Abram is a name for father. Like in Aramaic and Hebrew, we have the name Abba, which means daddy. Abram was a name for father. The problem is he wasn't a father of anybody yet. He was a father figure. And it's not until this covenant starts to come true that God begins to call him and the people begin to call him Abraham, because he is now the father of many. The father of many. When God shows up and he tells Abraham and Sarah this promise, Abraham's very quick to point out how old he is. He's 75 years at that point, and by the time the promise even comes, he's right around 100. His wife is nearly as old. And when Sarah hears the message, she actually names her first child without realizing it. When Sarah is told, because the reputation at the time is that Sarah, because she was infertile, wasn't able to have a child, they would describe her womb as dry as the dust. That's how she felt. That's how people looked at her, because she got her value from being able to have a family, and she couldn't. And so when an old woman is told at this very late age, she's probably, you know, working on funeral plans or something, probably putting a deposit down at the cemetery, God comes along and says, you're going to have a child, and this child is going to have descendants, and they're going to be as numerous, Abraham, as the stars in the sky and as countless as the sand on the seashore. Thousands and thousands and millions, you guys are going to be blessed with this child, and it's going to start this huge thing. What does Sarah do? She breaks out into laughter. And by breaking out into laughter, she names her first child, because the name Isaac in Hebrew means laughter. Isn't that the case sometimes when God steps into life and he wants to do a miracle? That sometimes when a miracle is so big, it's so overwhelming, the only response we could possibly have is just to break out into laughter, like a belly laugh, like, this is impossible. And so it was. Abraham and Sarah did have this child, the laughing baby. And Isaac was born, and it's a miracle. And you can kind of look here at this picture at this family lineage that comes out from Abraham as the Hebrew people are finally a people. They are called out from the other nations to be a light to the other nations. God needed to disperse the people, but at the same time, he needed to establish a family to care for his message, so that he could break into, when it was time, the great rescue plan. And you guys know the great rescue plan. That's the Christ child that's to come. And it's going to come from Abraham's family. So Abraham and Sarah have a child. Isaac is born. This is a dream. This is a miracle. I mean, I think they still laugh every time they wake up and they see this child. But the next scene, I could not do this justice because anytime I would show the next picture, only the Lego version is PG enough. Because every other picture that really depicts the story is really kind of scary. Because you might know, whenever somebody tells you that all religions are basically the same, ask them if they've ever really studied religions. Because at this time, what was happening in the nations is people were basically practicing a blood cult, a fertility cult. This type of religion has been practiced on nearly every continent in the world, and it is being practiced somewhere even till today, as advanced as we think we are. And a blood cult basically goes like this. You're wondering why your crops aren't growing and you're not getting rain. And to be able to entice the gods, because you're sure that the gods must be angry at you, you start with a practice of religion. And that's really what religion is. Religion is neither good nor bad. It is habits or practices we do to try to relate with God. And so in these ancient religions, this is exactly what they would do. They would start with what we might consider sort of worship, a type of prayer, a type of yelling, a type of begging, a type of singing, something. Maybe there's a magic formula. Maybe there's a secret code. Maybe if we say the Lord's Prayer with a thy instead of the new way, God listens better. And so they're going through all these formulas and all these things, and it's not working, and so they step it up a notch. Why don't we do animal sacrifices? And then they step it up a notch after that point. What about human blood sacrifices? And they actually practice cutting and bleeding, hoping that somehow this arouses the gods and their crops will grow. At the point where you're at famine and starvation, the human mind came up with a final sacrifice, which is the strongest sacrifice you can get. We invented this. This is our religion. This is what humans will come up with. They actually took a child and they sacrificed the child to get the gods to respond. And Abraham is challenged with the same thing. God comes to him. He has this miracle baby. He has the laughing child. And God tells him, take your child, take some wood. It's time for the sacrifice. And Abraham has to climb that mountain with his son, and his son trusts this man because he knows God speaks to his dad. And so he helps carry the wood. He helps set up the fire. And when his dad grabs the rope and puts it around him, perhaps for a time, he trusts his dad even then. And one of the things I really want you to know is don't look at this particular passage, which is real strong and it's really graphic, and I don't want you to look at this passage and think that God was only doing this to test Abraham. Because when Abraham took the knife and he pulled it up and God finally said, wait a minute, God provides the sacrifice, don't harm the child, and in fact, look over there in the thicket, there's a ram, and that becomes the sacrifice instead. I think what God was actually doing is he wanted Abraham to feel an emotion. When he had the knife up above, and he had a son, his one and only son, and it was time to sacrifice him. I think Abraham needed to feel what only God the Father feels when he would sacrifice his only begotten son in order to rescue all of humanity from sin, death, and evil. And so Abraham is faithful. He doesn't have to sacrifice his son. In fact, Isaac becomes a great nation, and we know that he has two sons, Jacob and Esau. These were twins that were born. But just to make sure that there's no birth order kind of debate here, Jacob grabs onto the heel of Esau when he's coming out so that Esau could never claim. This is a newborn baby grabbing a heel because he wants to make sure that that birthright doesn't go to Esau. We also know from Scripture that the two of them seem to wrestle and tussle a little bit in the womb. I don't know if anybody here has had twins and triplets and experienced that fighting, Matthew, Jacob, and Christopher. I don't know if you remember if you fought in the womb ever. They did. And when they come out, Esau is a hunter. He's red-haired. He's hairy all over. And he's a man's man. And his father prefers him. When Jacob comes out, he's Rebekah's favorite. He's more loving. He's more emotional. But he's also very sharp intellectually. And he steals the birthright. He steals this promise. He gets to be the people of God because he sold out his brother for a bowl of stew. That's how stubborn Esau was. I want to eat. Give me the birthright. Okay. He sells out the birthright for a bowl of stew. And Jacob ends up having a family. Jacob's family is a little bit more convoluted because the Bible never endorses polygamy ever. It never endorses polygamy ever. But you do see it practiced. And in this case, Jacob thought that he had won the hand of the beautiful daughter, but instead the father snuck in the ugly daughter. And then he decided that he needed the beautiful daughter too. And when the two of them were having perhaps pregnancy problems, he thought it was a good idea to have babies also with two of the servants of his wives. So in a sense, Jacob had four wives, 12 kids, and I can imagine what that household must have been like. But Joseph's the favorite, and although I don't like the musical, a couple of the songs are okay. You know the story of Joseph, right? His father gives him a beautiful coat. He prefers Joseph. He sees something in Joseph. The brothers are jealous. They were going to kill him, but they end up selling him into slavery, and he ends up in Egypt at the bottom of the totem pole. And from the bottom of the totem pole, Joseph does the same thing that Daniel was doing from our sermon series this summer. He was faithful to God, and he was really wise in how he filled out his work. He was faithful to God, and he had integrity and wisdom in all the work that he did. And he rose not only up the totem pole, he rose to the point where he was second in charge of Egypt, below Pharaoh only. And Pharaoh was the Julius Caesar of his day. This is the most powerful man in the world. How is it that God keeps managing all the time to take his Hebrew people and in the midst of chaos and everything else, finds a way to get them up near the top? But they're called to be a light to the Gentiles. And we know the story of Joseph when he's near the top. His brothers and later on his father, they come to Egypt because of the famine. They now realize who he is. He takes him into the household. And at least for a period of time, we know that the Hebrew people flourished and grew and survived partially because of the wisdom of Joseph. A good man. But after some amount of time, the Bible only gives us basically this one line. But the new Pharaoh did not remember the promise that the old Pharaohs had made with Joseph's family. And over time, he began to enslave them. And we know that the Jewish people were so enslaved because Pharaoh had big aspirations. He wanted to take over the world. He needed a mightier army. He wanted to build pyramids. He needed all these things, and he used the foreign people and took advantage of them. It got to one point where Pharaoh actually worried that there were too many of them. And what if they rise up against me? What if they have a coup? So Pharaoh was a very smart ruler, if not evil, and decided that the easiest thing to do would be to wipe out the next generation of leaders. And so he took the firstborn from every family and killed them. That's how you make sure nobody has a coup. You get rid of the next generation of leaders. And he did that. And Moses, of course, you know his story. How does God do this kind of stuff? He's put in a basket, he's floated down the river, and where does the basket end up? Next to Pharaoh's palace. And what family does he begin to live with? Pharaoh's daughter in the palace of Pharaoh. And not only that, they have to find a nursemaid, a midwife, to care for the child, because of course, Pharaoh's daughter's not lactating. She didn't have a baby. So who do they find to nurse the baby? Moses' own mom. I can just imagine Sarah laughing in heaven. God, how do you do this kind of stuff? And you know the rest of the story. Moses, over time, finds God's voice. He knows what God wants him to do. The plagues happen. He leads the people out of Egypt. They survive through the spread part of the sea. And we all know that that becomes the defining story of the Hebrew people. If God can drive back the seas and take his people through with the mightiest army in the world coming upon them, then there's nothing this God cannot do. That becomes their framing story. And much of it is very important because Moses, when he's finally leading the people, God realizes it's a whole lot easier to get the slave out of Egypt God just snapped his fingers and get the slave out of Egypt. But it's a whole lot harder to get Egypt out of the slave. And so he starts with this covenant promise. He takes Abraham's covenant that you will be my people and I will make you a light to the Gentiles. And he says, I need to add more to it. I need some laws around it because I got to protect you because you're like kindergarten children. And when you're in the hallway, everybody has to hold hands and then hold their other finger over their mouth and be really, really quiet. When they come in the classroom, you have to sit and be quiet and lay your hands down. You don't have to do that in college, do you? But see, these slaves still had a little bit of Egypt in them. And so they needed a really tight wall. They needed fences that were very, very high. They could not be trusted with the keys to the gate. Because if they were to go out there in the world, their whole life was just, they didn't know how to live right. And so for those of you who think of Charlton Heston as your Moses, here's your picture. Moses from Sinai has the covenant, the Ten Commandments, the two tablets, and he takes them down. And we know that over time, he ends up building an ark, which is a box. Not to be confused with the ark that's a boat. This is an ark that's a box. I think God uses that word in both cases on purpose. And he puts the tablets in there and encloses it, but even though I read the Bible and I know all the stuff from the Bible about the Ark of the Covenant, when did I really learn about the Ark of the Covenant? Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark, anybody? I think it's just because I like watching Nazis melt. It's really cool. And so here comes the Ark of the Covenant. Just imagine everywhere the Hebrew people went, the priests, which probably didn't look like these girls, the priests would carry in the Ark in front of them. They had to make sure that they were fully purified because just being close to the box, the full presence of God, was dangerous. Right on the top step and facing the people. Perfect. And if you know anything from Raiders of the Lost Ark, when the Nazis decided they wanted to unleash this power because they knew this power was powerful, when they would lift the lid, what happened? The full presence of God, they weren't purified and they couldn't handle it. And actually, when you see this box, it would have been a little bigger, okay? The Ark of the Covenant would have been a little bigger, but more or less shaped like this. When you see this box, I want you to think of one more story. What did Jesus' laying spot look like when he was resurrected? See, he was in a cave, and in the cave, there would have been a table, a piece of rock that was cut out. And we know that his linens were laid there, the shroud or whatever. The linens were laid there. But what happened at this particular place when Jesus was resurrected? Who was at either side of the mercy seat, the place where Jesus laid? Two angels. What were the two angels doing? They were leaning towards each other and touching wings. What the resurrection story is telling us, and sometimes we forget this because we don't watch enough Raiders of the Lost Ark, you need to see the box so you understand what the story is telling you is forever and ever and ever, every year on the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, the Hebrew high priest would come in once a year and he would take the final sacrifice and he would purify himself and he would come into the Holy of Holies behind a curtain. And he would come and he would pour this blood so that the people could be purified for one more year. They had other little smaller sacrifices, but the big one came once a year. Now, there's a myth, it's a legend, we don't know if it's true, it could be true, that when the high priest would go in, just in case he wasn't fully purified or wasn't qualified, that the other priest would tie a rope around his ankle so that he went in, if he got into the presence of God and he wasn't fully purified, he would drop dead. And apparently they did this because it happened a couple times. And there'd be no way to get the body out because nobody else is the high priest and nobody else has gone through the purification until the next year, right? And you can imagine what a dead high priest smells like after 1 year in the tabernacle of God. And so there's this tradition, legend, probably, maybe true, they tied a rope and so if he did happen to die in the presence of this box, that they could just drag him out and start over again with the new high priest. Here's the thing to remember. Something about the world at the Tower of Babel and during the story of Abraham, got to the point where apparently we were so sinful. We were so sinful that God literally had to veil himself. Because just his Shekinah, his glory, his holiness, was so much that we would all fall dead. And so he had to veil himself, he had to encase himself, he had to make this the place where the full presence is found. At the story of the crucifixion, what happens when the earthquake rolls on through? The veil in the temple does what? It rips. And guess what didn't happen? Nobody died. And nobody died because the presence of God was now fully with us, except instead it was the resurrected Christ himself who has reconciled us through the cross and through his blood. It's Jesus standing before the people who has already established the mercy seat and has poured out his own blood so that no blood would ever be poured again. It's the ultimate story of reconciliation, restoration, justification, his grace for you just because he loves you. And so Moses has this covenant with the people. He has these commandments, and they set up this religious system, but that was never going to be the point. And even when it's time to get to the promised land, there's just one more person I want to tell you about. Moses found out that he wasn't going to be allowed to go into the city. In fact, his time with leading God's people was now over. He was going to be the man of the law, but there would have to be a new leader that would lead the people in, and his name was Jesus. Actually, his name was Joshua, right? But Jesus' name in Hebrew is Yeshua. And Joshua's name in Hebrew is Yeshua. So if your name is Josh, you have the exact same name as Jesus. His name was Joshua. And what is the goal of Joshua for the temporary Hebrew people of God sometime, I don't know, 3,300 years ago? To lead God's people into the Holy Land, the Promised Land, right? Land flowing with milk and honey. So he did that in a temporary scale. What is the role of Yeshua, Joshua, Jesus, the real promised Savior for all people, for the earth, even for the dead? What is his role? To lead us to the Promised Land, a new heaven, a new earth. Their two stories are mirrored. And how does Joshua conquer a nation they have no business conquering? Remember, he's leading slaves. People who have been slaves and for the last 40 years, that whole generation has died off. And so these are the children of slaves. How does he beat them? He does it with a worship service. He takes the musicians and the priests, and he takes this box, the ark, and they go around the city praying and worshiping, and then they blow a horn. And when the walls came a-tumbling down, the promise of God was finally realized. So this is the covenant. We talked about the garden. We talked about the covenant. And next week, we're going to continue as we talk about the kingdom, because for some reason, the Hebrew people weren't satisfied with having a covenant relationship with God. They decided, as they looked jealously at all the other nations, oh, we want a king like them. And we'll see how it goes. I'll invite our ushers forward now at this time as we receive our offering today. God be with all of you.